From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. I'm hosting the show while Julie Bierrock is away. On today's edition, Christopher Conover covers the Pima County Board of Supervisors' reaction to a developer's plan to open up a new copper mining operation in the Santa Rita Mountains. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords has had to hit the ground running in Washington. January isn't even over yet, and she finds herself serving on three committees that are concerned with some of the most crucial issues facing our country. Bill Buckmaster will have an interview. The Center for Biological Diversity is based in Tucson, but their concerns are definitely global. They are instrumental in the attempt to classify polar bears as an endangered species, and I'll speak with the center's policy director on what this means in the effort to curb global warming. Also, downtown Tucson is celebrating the 1930s this weekend with Dillinger Days, and Soo Young Lee has a preview of what's in store. That's all next here on Arizona Spotlight. Copper mining was once an important part of our state's history, but what role does it have in our future? Opinions on that differ wildly. A Canadian-based company is hoping to open a new copper pit in southern Pima County, but the Board of Supervisors is standing squarely in the way. Christopher Conover has the report.
It was nearly standing room only at Tuesday's meeting of the Pima County Board of Supervisors. More than 100 people filed the paperwork to speak about a proposed mine on the eastern slope of the Santa Rita Mountains in southern Pima County. But before they got their chance to speak their piece, Jamie Sturgis with Augusta Resources, the company hoping to dig and operate what is known as the Rosemont Mine, was allowed to give a presentation to those assembled. He said copper mines are important to the national economy.
We need to balance production and protection in this country. This is not just a local issue. I know a lot of people say politics is local. All politics are local, and in part they are, but there's also national politics. And the natural resource in the Rosemont deposit is not insignificant. It's not irrelevant to these people in Pima County.
While most of the people in the audience were against the mine, a few were there to support the idea, including Ann Patterson. She said some of the arguments used by those opposing the mine were just wrong.
I've also heard arguments that we should leave all the mining to third world countries, and I would say that this is environmental imperialism of the worst sort. You would have something that you perceive as bad, leave a state like Arizona or a country like the U.S. that has the dollars, the knowledge, the technology, and the rules to make mining safe. And that includes environmental. We can keep accidents from happening. And third world countries don't have that will or money. And how, you know, what's that doing for Mother Earth?
The proposed mine is on property owned by Augusta, but much of it rests within the Coronado National Forest. So the Board of Supervisors unanimously passed a resolution asking Congress to change the designation on the property so that it cannot be mined. Supervisor Ray Carroll, who led the effort against the mine, said while getting congressional action on the mine may seem like a long shot, history is on the county's side.
About 10 years ago, John McCain and Jim Colby were successful in getting Newmont Mine to retract their ability to mine in southern Arizona. So Jim Colby has some experience with this, and hopefully he will offer his help and crafting the next step of lobbying to the feds to try to get them to again restrict the ability of Augusta or any other mining entity to create an open pit mine in the Santa Rita Mountains, which the people obviously are against.
Another plus for the county is that Congressman Raul Grijalva is the chair of the House subcommittee that would initially handle the land use change. There is one caveat, however, to all of the wrangling. The county had a chance to buy the Rosemont property in the mid-1990s. The land at the time was owned by ASARCO and purchased by a private individual who then offered it to the county. But the county didn't bite, so the property was sold to the Canadian-based Augusta Resources, which now wants to dig the mine. Even if the county is eventually successful in keeping the mine from being dug, there are those who worry the property will be sold to developers instead. and the land then will be covered with houses. Supervisor Carroll says, based on past board action, don't count on that.
We have downplanned most areas, including the Emperita, the Posta Quemada, the Tanque Verde, and the Sabino Canyon areas. We've downplanned all those areas successfully. And in fact, I don't believe that anyone who purchased the Rosemont Junction piece would ever get any type of an upplanting or an upzoning on that land.
No matter what happens to the land, don't look for a final decision anytime soon. The process could take years. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Gabrielle Giffords is still in her first month on the job, representing the Arizona 8th Congressional District, and already she's been named to three key House committees: Armed Services, Foreign Affairs, and Science and Technology. Bill Buckmaster recently sat down with Congresswoman Giffords to discuss her new role.
Congresswoman, good to see you.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
So how would you characterize the start of your congressional career?
Well, exciting, chaotic, humbling, as you can imagine, with so much anticipation for this new Congress and a new direction in Washington. I'm humbled to be part of this new group of incoming freshmen, and I'm also looking forward to working with Democrats and Republicans that have a lot more experience than I to solve some very complex, complicated issues.
It's got to be gratifying scoring some really good committees right out of the gate.
Yeah, I'm really glad to work with leadership both at Davis-Monthan and Fort Huachuca to make sure that my subcommittees adequately dealt with the issues that we face on those bases. So Readiness was my first subcommittee that will have an influence in the base realignment and closing that will come up that process in the next couple of years. Also air and land forces, which will be important as well. So I'm excited about the committees and the subcommittees, and certainly excited to be part of a freshman class that this speaker has given a lot more autonomy and authority to than in past years.
And speaking of the armed services and foreign affairs, of course, President Bush ordering more troops, perhaps more than 20,000 to Iraq. What was your reaction to the president's message?
The president's message came to the American people on Wednesday night, and in our House Armed Services Committee on Thursday, both Secretary Gates, the new Secretary of Defense, and also General Pace, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came to testify over 5 hours. And even as a freshman, I was able to ask questions that pertain to the district and certainly to the war in Iraq. Bill, I have great concerns about a strategy which is essentially stay the course plus 20,000. We need a real plan, real accountability, and we need to, in my opinion, focus more on the Baker-Hamilton solutions, which talks about a strategic redeployment and working on other nations and making sure that our troops are prepared and ready to deal with threats that will happen across the world. So I'm concerned that the president's plan is not adequate, does not hold the Iraqi government accountable, there's no real enforcement mechanisms, and I'm concerned about the strain on our troops right now.
What about when the American troops leave, destabilizing that region? Some worry that the civil war in Iraq could certainly turn into something a lot larger and be more of a regional war.
Well, of course, there's a lot of unknowns. Iran is an unknown. Certainly the Palestinian-Israeli situation is an unknown. And that's where I believe so fundamentally that we send our troops in to remove a horrible dictator and our troops performed heroically. Then we send our troops in to find weapons of mass destruction. There were no weapons of mass destruction to be found. And now our troops are getting bogged down in not a military conflict, but a political conflict. And the Iraqi people now have a new government, they have a constitution, they have resources and revenues from the oil. They need to step up and make the sacrifices to step up to fight for their country like Americans are fighting for the country of Iraq.
Let's talk about your first speech on the House floor, the House of Representatives, that mm-hmm. speech dealing with border security and immigration.
Yes.
Think we're going to see some real immigration reform out of this Congress?
I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic. I'm already working with Democrats and Republicans to understand what has been done, who are potential allies. We had our first delegation meeting with all 8 members, 4 Ds and 4 Rs from the House, and our 2 U.S. senators for breakfast on Wednesday or Thursday morning. I can't remember which.
The Arizona delegation.
The Arizona delegation. Immigration's a top critical issue. And there's not complete consensus, but I have always supported the approach of Senator John McCain, which is a comprehensive approach. I think it's disconcerting that Jeff Flake, the congressman from the Phoenix area, who also supported a comprehensive approach, was removed from his party from the Judiciary Committee for speaking out on that, which it does not bode well for some of the people in those key places that we're going to need. But it is a top issue. It's not part of the first 100 hours, but it is something that we need to focus on, and I'm going to work very, very hard to make sure that that we have comprehensive immigration reform.
But are you optimistic this session, perhaps, we'll see something?
Well, Bill, when I get lobbied by the taxi driver on the way to the Capitol on immigration, you know that it cuts across the country, it cuts across party lines, and I think most members know that.
As far as a border fence, 700 miles was approved, but not the funding for it during the last session.
Unfortunately, I believe this was a political gesture so people could come home and say, see, we did something about immigration, and frankly, we didn't. High-tech security is the way to go. Certainly, enforcement in terms of radar, drones, electronic surveillance, but building a wall is not the solution. And the political will is not there. The money is not going to be there. So we need to look at other approaches.
Are you pleased with the pace of things, dealing with some pretty serious issues right out of the gate?
First and foremost, ethics reform, lobbying reform, earmark reform. That was the first piece of the 100 hours, had bipartisan support. Then we moved on to raising the minimum wage. We did that in Arizona. Now we did that in the House across the entire country. Stem cell research. President vetoed it, first and only veto. Hopefully he will reconsider the next time. If not, we will bring it up again. Implementing the bipartisan recommendations of the 9/11 Commission had bipartisan support, not unanimous, but bipartisan. Pay-as-you-go rules so that we can focus on real budgetary matters that are spiraling out of control with both debt and deficit. Now, next week, starting tomorrow, we're going to deal with cutting the interest for student loans, and also, instead of continuing to subsidize the oil and gas companies, reinvesting and investing in renewable energy. So I'm excited about this first 100 hours, and I think this Congress, again, bipartisan, is moving forward on some issues that are critically important to the American people.
It's a busy start in 2007, and congratulations. It sounds like you're right in the thick of it, and we'll look forward to having you home again and being with us. Thanks.
Bill, thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up after the break, even as their own habitat is dwindling, polar bears may be playing a vital role in helping us face the causes of global warming. And we'll have a look at this weekend's downtown Dillinger Day celebration from Soo Young Lee here on Arizona Spotlight. In 1997, during the Clinton administration, the U.S. took part in drawing up an agreement called the Kyoto Protocols. The treaty sought to limit the amount of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases that could be emitted by the signatory nations. But later, the Bush administration declined to ratify the Kyoto Agreement. The rise of greenhouse gas emissions and their effect on global warming has been observed by scientists internationally. One group here in Tucson hopes to use the scientific data gathered on polar bears to effect change on our nation's environmental law and provide the regulation that the Kyoto Protocols currently cannot. Joining me in the studio today is the policy director and one of the founders of the Center for Biological Diversity, Kieran Suckling. Thank you for coming into the studio. So first of all, let's start by telling our listeners a little bit about the Center for Biological Diversity.
We're a Tucson-based national environmental group with our primary focus being on protection of endangered species. And we kind of specialize at being at the intersection of law and science. So we do a lot of scientific research. But we do that with a strong eye toward where does science meet up with environmental law and environmental policy, and how can we use those laws and policies to advance environmental protection.
Okay. I think the story that we're talking about today begins with a petition that was filed in December 2005.
Yes. We filed a petition with the government to list the polar bear as an endangered species because due to global warming, the sea ice, which the polar bear depends on, is melting away beneath its feet, and scientists predict that by about 2040, we could see a complete disappearance of summer sea ice in the Arctic, which would surely drive the polar bear extinct.
What would be significant about getting the polar bears on the Endangered Species Act list?
The Endangered Species Act requires that the federal government take concrete steps to protect the species. In this case, that's going to mean reducing greenhouse gas emissions and lowering the level of global warming. It requires a recovery plan. And most interesting, I think, is that the Endangered Species Act is unique in that it says that all decisions regarding the polar bear had to be made purely on the best available scientific information. And so it builds a wall around the science to shield it from political considerations, from economic considerations. So the listing of the polar bear really, I think, is going to dramatically, well, already has dramatically turned around the whole debate about global warming by creating a forum where action must be taken and where that action has to be based on scientific studies rather than political struggle. So we really hope, I mean, the polar bear is not going to end global warming all by itself, but it's a dramatic new variable to change the whole debate, change the whole management structure of global warming.
A year later, in December 2006, what was the result of the petition?
The Bush administration came out and said, yes, we agree. The science says global warming is melting away the sea ice. The polar bear is threatened by this, and so they propose to place it on the endangered species list. And that's the first step to getting a final rule, which will occur in 1 year. So we were both we were kind of surprised on the one hand because the administration is so hostile to both endangered species and anything to do with global warming, but on the other hand, the science is so clear. They were really boxed in. It would have been very, very difficult for them to say no. The polar bear is not imperiled. Mm-hmm. What was most intriguing about their announcement, though, is they said, "Okay, there is global warming. The ice is melting." And then they said, however, we will not discuss or identify any of the causes of global warming.
Do we have other examples of how listing a species on the Endangered Species Act list has affected environmental law? Or?
Oh, sure. For example, here in Arizona, when the Mexican spotted owl was put onto the threatened species list, that caused a revolution in forest management here, and to a great degree ended the logging of old-growth forests in the Southwest and helped shift the whole focus toward restoration. The placement of the Southwestern willow flycatcher, an endangered songbird, which requires healthy streams and riparian forests, it was put on the endangered species list in about 93 or so. And then protections that came in for it ultimately resulted in livestock being pulled off of about 300 miles of river in Arizona, New Mexico, and California. And those rivers are now restoring dramatically.
And scientists doing studies on polar bears can directly attribute the connection between greenhouse gases and the loss of habitat for the polar bears?
Polar bears spend almost all their time on sea ice, and that's where they hunt from. And so when there's less sea ice or when the pieces have melted so they're farther apart, has to swim between them, it's less successful in hunting. They have higher rates of drowning. The bears, the adult bears are smaller because they're not getting as much food. Young bears have much higher mortality rates, again, lack of food. And so we know that, so the decline of sea ice is strongly correlated with the decline of the polar bear. And then the next step is, well, what's causing the sea ice to decline? And there's a strong correlation there showing that as carbon and methane emissions go up, the temperature in the Arctic goes up and the sea ice melts. And in fact, we usually talk about global warming in a global sense, but actually global warming isn't happening the same all over the Earth. The northern hemisphere is warming faster than the southern hemisphere. And so the Arctic is melting faster than any place else on Earth, and that's where we're seeing the most dramatic changes.
I understand that until April of this year, that comments on the proposal are being accepted. What does this mean?
When the government came out and said, okay, we're going to propose to list the polar bear, that opened a 90-day comment period in which any citizen, scientist, or local government then can write to the Fish and Wildlife Service and provide information or give its opinion about whether the species should be protected or not. In general, the Endangered Species Act has lots of these public comment programs in order to get as much information as possible into the system. And I would certainly encourage any listener today who has an opinion or information about polar bears to send in comments to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The website endangeredearth.org will put you in touch with the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson. Comments from the public on the endangerment of polar bears are being accepted until April 9th of this year, before the Bush administration makes a final decision regarding the listing of polar bears in January 2008. The website again is endangeredearth.org. Downtown Tucson will turn back the clock to 1934 this weekend. Some of our city landmarks become the backdrop for dramatic reenactments of the capture of John Dillinger and his gang. Soo Young Lee takes us to an exhibit at the historic train depot, which focuses on the transportation aspect of that historical event.
It all started in 1934 when a fire at the Hotel Congress forced all the guests to evacuate the building. Some guests would not leave and needed to be rescued by the aerial ladder. Later, one of those guests paid the Tucson fireman $12 to go back into the fire and retrieve his bags. Unknown to the firemen, the bags were filled with money from bank robberies. That guest was part of Dillinger's gang. It was the beginning of the end for Dillinger. In 1934, Public Enemy No. 1 was captured by the Tucson police without a single shot fired. For the Tucson Police Department, then made up of 35 policemen covering 7 square miles, this capture was an event to remember. The remembrance continues to this day as the Dillinger Days.
We're celebrating the 1930s, we're celebrating Tucson, we're celebrating Tucson Police Department and the Fire Department. After they had eluded police in over 5 states, he was always escaping after being captured as well. And they were able to do this feat without a shot being fired and without Dillinger escaping before he could be extradited. So it's pretty amazing.
This is the 1673, yeah. Built in 1900. Was actually given to the citizens of Tucson.
Laura Kaywood Barker isn't quite into cowboy gunfights or mobster legends, but when it comes to the story of Dillinger, she's excited because it is part of history.
The pride they must have felt. I think something to be celebrated. We're not glorifying the criminals. We're we're talking about the past, we're talking about history. We really run into that issue a lot, being in southern Arizona, having gangsters and wild men down here in this region, and how do you handle that? Well, it's part of history, and it does need to be interpreted.
Also, as a director of the Southern Arizona Transportation Museum, Barker was interested in how Dillinger and his friends came to Tucson.
A lot of people assume that since Dillinger's friends were extradited by train and Dillinger by plane, that they must have come on the train, which was the predominant mode of transportation for most U.S. citizens at that time, 1934. But no, they actually came the highway system that was vastly improving at that time because of Roosevelt's New Deal plan. He needed to get the nation working again, and so he really was improving the nation's highway systems all throughout the 30s. And the result of that is a nationwide campaign really promoting the use of that highway system, that it was safe to travel by car, that there were great cities along the way that would welcome you into their hotels and their restaurants. And so it's just a testament that Dillinger actually arrived in that form.
A small exhibit at the museum, located in the historic depot in downtown, focuses on the transportation aspect of the Dillinger capture in Tucson.
It really gives you an overall view of transportation at that time period. When people see the American Airways plane that was very similar to the one Dillinger would have been extradited on, they're suddenly transformed back to 1934, or possibly for the first time if they're a young person, and realizing, my goodness, that is a tiny plane. We're not talking about a commercial airline that we all step on, you know, two or three times a year. We're talking about a little puddle hopper, you know, that's transportation in the 30s. Crossing the United States in an automobile doesn't seem like a huge task now, but back then it was quite an adventure to think about doing that.
Barker hopes to show off the newly restored depot and the museum during the Dillinger Days celebration.
We have wonderful reenactments. We also have lectures. We also have the movie High Sierra playing at the Rialto Theater. There's an antique car show going on, antique fair, art show. Of course, our exhibit here focusing on the transportation aspect of Dillinger. So it's going to be a great day.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Suyan Lee.
Dillinger Days will also feature music from DJ Kid Squid, plus Al Perry, Joe Bourne, The Last Call Girls, and more, along with the walking tours, lectures, and historical reenactments. It is tomorrow from 10 until 5 in downtown Tucson. Information online at downtowntucson.org or 547-3338. All of the events are open to the public. And that's Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Mark McLemore.